Welcome to another edition of the Better Than I Found It podcast. I'm Mike McGraw, your host today and the men's golf coach at Baylor University. My guest today is a Hall of Fame golf coach, Bruce Hepler from Georgia Tech University. Bruce is not just a good friend of mine, but he's a great, great coach. His record on the course really speaks for itself, but his impact on his university, his players, and college golf in general has really been dramatic and actually transformational. I think you'll love listening to his wisdom, and so let's get right to that interview. Okay, I'd like to welcome Bruce Hepler to the Better Than I Found It podcast today. Bruce, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Just hanging out here in Waco, waiting for our golf team to get back. And I know you're not in Atlanta, Georgia. Where are you this week?
We've decided to take a little road trip and start early. Obviously, with the ACC's decision this fall, we didn't get to do anything. So we've started a little bit early. And with the NCAA course no longer being a neutral site, we decided to spend a week out here in Arizona, enjoy some of the sunshine. And we're starting our spring season a little bit earlier. So we thought we'd do our qualifying out here.
Well, that's a great idea. Now I know why I can't ever beat you, Bruce. You're always thinking ahead of me. I like that.
Enough of that.
Okay. Well, I beat you occasionally. I think we beat each other up pretty much about the same. So, but that is a good idea. I hope you're enjoying sunny Arizona this week. And so I'd like to begin by just kind of letting people know a little bit more about your past. I mean, I know very well your history and where you've been and what you've done. A lot of people that may or may not be listening may not know some of those things about you. So I know this. You played 1 year of college golf at Dixie College and then transferred to BYU. And you got your degree in accounting. Did you get a master's there as well?
No, just a bachelor's and then went to work at a CPA firm.
Okay. So in 1985, I guess?
Yes.
And then you became how in the world did you become the head coach at Amherst men's and women's golf? I mean, you just decided you wanted to get into coaching. I mean, what was the impetus? What got you going toward coaching?
Well, I started working as an accountant and kind of didn't have a lot of fun with that. I promised my parents, though, I would get the CPA exam passed. All the money they'd spent putting me through college, I thought it would be really unfair to lead the profession. So I just started thinking about it. I was working with another young guy in Salt Lake City at the firm who played basketball at BYU Hawaii. And we just started looking into, you know, maybe some athletic administration rather than just doing straight accounting. Obviously, as you know, the budgets have climbed into the 60, 70, 80, even over $100 million. And the old offensive line coach probably isn't qualified to do that stuff anymore. So I went and asked some questions down in Provo about how do you get into that. And they basically said that if you don't know anyone, I don't like your chances. They mentioned there were a couple graduate programs that might lead to something. And one of them was at UMass and the other one was Ohio U. And so spent a lot of time that fall, worked really hard and was fortunate enough to pass the CPA exam, the all parts fully, which is probably one of my greater accomplishments. That's not a lot of people do that, but worked there for a year and got in grad school at UMass. So my wife and I loaded up the Ryder truck and towed our car back to Massachusetts and entered the master's program there for a year. Worked in the intramural department, making $52.63 a week, along with having my tuition paid for there. And in the middle of that couple weeks there, Tracy Mayer, a very famous Division III coach at Amherst College, came over and said, "Hey, I want to go on sabbatical." I guess they do those things at small liberal arts schools still. "And does anyone want to coach my men's and women's teams? And I'll give you $1,000 a year for each of them." And I raised my hand with my $52.63. "I'll take every dime I can get." So I was actually in grad school working in the intramural department and then took those jobs and with the guys and the girls. And Mike, that was really where my mindset started to change. I really enjoyed those young people. I took it a little more serious than they did. Division III, we were having a great year and ready to go win the conference. And three guys walked in and said, "Oh, we're not going to the conference tournament. We've got schoolwork to do." Mm. And that's when I knew that Division III was a little bit different. But I really enjoyed that and just kind of put that in the back of my mind and finished up there. And I had a chance to either do an internship or a thesis. And I knew a thesis was not going to get me a job. So my academic advisor had worked with the AD at UNLV some many years earlier And he called him up and said, hey, I've got this young man from the West Coast, who's CPA, did really well in our program, but he'd like to come work for you for a few months. And at that point, it was load up the Ryder truck again and tow the car all the way to Las Vegas and start working in the athletic department there.
And that's long how answer. You got to UNLV. And yes. You spent a couple of years and got to know Dwayne Knight. And that must be kind of the genesis of how that happened.
Yeah, it's a long and winding road, certainly.
Well, what a great place to be in the 1980s in college golf. I mean, Dwayne was building a great program and you got that opportunity. And didn't he put you in charge of his foundation for a few years or not?
Yeah, that was really kind of the kickstarter to the whole thing. They started when he got there. The Las Vegas founders got very involved with the golf program there. They had been running the three professional events and were very instrumental in actually forcing UNLV to kind of move things in a different direction. So they decided to start a foundation, which was a little unusual outside of the university. And I raised my hand again and said, I'll do the accounting for that. And accounting led from doing the accounting to actually get involved in running the event and helping Dwayne with that. And then one thing led to another. And I'd actually taken the team a few times in the hiring process. So before I knew it, I had two jobs and I was being paid for one. And we had some success early on in recruiting and some different things. And Dwayne actually had a couple options to leave there pretty quickly. And was fortunate for me, he thought enough of what I was doing, helping with things, that he went down the hall and said, look, I'll stay, but I want to hire this guy full time. And Mike, you can remember probably at that time, I may have been the only full time assistant golf coach in the country. There were others who were grad assistants, but I may have been the only one who was involved in recruiting and raising money and really doing it full time at that point. So they wanted to keep Dwayne around. So all of a sudden I moved from about 15 away from administration to help him full time.
Well, it's kind of funny how that evolved. And it wasn't like it was a financial boon for you either. I mean, I know you were making, I think, $16,000 a year. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, that's what I made when I went to work at Oklahoma State. My wife was so thrilled that I got the offer from Mike Holder to go to work there, and I was taking an $18,000 pay cut. She didn't know it until after we already moved. So I was pretty good about that. But you got to work with Dwayne, which is a great experience. And during that time, at least the 2 years I know you were his assistant, a young man named Eldrick Tiger Woods from California, Cypress, California, was burst onto the scene, and he was somebody you recruited. Tell me anything about the
interview. We don't have enough time. No, really, I remember one of my first events that I went to was the year that he lost. I went to the one that he played, I think it was his first one, at Lake Merced. And there were not a lot of us there. Our good best friend, mutual friend, Mike Holder, was there, and we kind of struck up a little bit of a friendship on the road, and he'd watch me do some stuff. And so all of a sudden you see this young kid, and it's as mesmerizing. It really was, Mike. It was the same experience that everybody had 2 weekends ago watching little Charlie play.
Right.
I mean, you really could not believe what you were seeing. I mean, it was so far superior to anyone else. So you just started watching it kind of, and I'd heard about this stuff at Junior World a little bit earlier on when he was younger. And I'm watching this and I'm watching this. And every now and then I sneak over to watch another kid named Matt Todd to not let Mike know what I was doing. But I think I watched every shot that Tiger hit there, including he was not well the semis and lost to Dennis Hillman. And then Matthew Todd ended up winning the U.S. Junior that year. And we signed him at UNLV, which I think may have gotten Mike's attention a little bit about what we're capable of doing. And from that point on, I watched the next three that he played in. I watched every match. I watched every shot. And I've got stories of stuff that it almost make you feel like that putt against Bob May. I've seen 8 or 9 of those things where he almost just willed the ball into the hole. I'll tell you one. It was his last one. And he'd beaten Ryan Armour the year before pretty badly. And Ryan had swore he would get back and play him. And he ran into him in the finals. And by this point, that driver had gotten a little wild. And he kind of put it away most of the day, and I've never saw Tiger Woods one time in all those matches ever lose a hole. He had guys win holes, never lost a hole, and I think we're going down maybe 16 was a par 3, I think, or 15, And no, it was a par 3 16, and he was one down. I said, "There you go. He's going to win this, no problem." And he actually lost the hole to go two down with two to play. Mm. And there was a long par 4, and there was a bunker right in the middle of the fairway. And Ryan Armour did what he's supposed to. He hit his 3-iron short of there. Well, out comes, rips off the Tiger, grabs a driver, and he hits this thing almost 60 yards over the bunker, right down the middle. Ryan Armour hits his next iron shot about 20 feet. Tiger hits it to about 8 feet, makes it one down. They go to 18, and he just takes his driver, and it seemed like it was a 600-yard hole even back then, and smokes the driver. Ryan does what he's supposed to. Hits his iron down the fairway. It's a 3-shot hole for most people. It's another iron shot, and Tiger goes at this green, and he ends up in a greenside bunker with about 18 yards of carry to a front right pin. And Ryan hits his wedge to about 12 feet right there, hole, just like he's supposed to do. And he steps in that bunker, and he hits it about 5 feet, and he makes it. And we're going extra holes. And I'll never forget, I walked over to that tee, probably not supposed to be talking, and I really didn't know us. And Earl Woods, who I had walked with hole after hole after hole. And Earl used to wear those headphones so no one could talk to him. And he pulled them out, and he looked at me, and he said, "Boy, how'd you like to coach that for 4 years?" So it was, there were magical moments, Mike. His match against Mark Wilson was incredible. A match that he played against Tommy Breershank down at Bay Hill, some stuff went on there. So we could go on for a long time about that, but it was really wonderful to watch something that special, so much of it.
Yeah, I was a high school golf coach at the time and watching it from afar. And Mike Holder once told me the first time I ever saw Tiger, he said he was the best player I'd ever seen in his life. The kid was 13 years old. And I said,
Not an exaggeration, I promise.
He said, "No, I knew he was going to be the best player I'd ever seen in my entire life for sure at that time." So that's kind of neat. You got to know Tiger and Earl during that process. Did you guys get him there for a visit at UNLV or not?
No, Mike, I made a mistake. I got a new job at that point in time. And he did visit UNLV through our efforts. But I remember it was July 1 back then when the rule was July 1. And Mike and I were talking. He said, "You know what, Bruce?" He said, "We ain't going to get that guy. Why don't you go ahead and make the phone call?" So I called on July 1. And I'm sure Tiger was not home on purpose. And I got with Earl, and he said, "Bruce, you're a wonderful guy, and we think the world of you, but I'm just letting you know, you have just chosen the last place in the world to coach. If you want to coach my son, he's not going to leave California." So that was kind of the end of the for myself as well as Oklahoma State.
Well, there were a lot of kids. I mean, Stillwater's not for everybody. Waco's not for everybody. Atlanta's not for everybody. So you just kind of, yeah, sometimes it's not the cards. So
yeah, he's managed to win okay there in Stillwater, no problem.
Yes, of course. Well, you know, I noticed that before you did leave UNLV, you did coach an NCAA individual champion, Warren Skuda. Tell me about Warren.
Well, you know, that kind of goes back to, I don't know if you know or not, I've served an LDS church mission.
Yes.
In South Africa. And so I spoke the language that Warren spoke. And he played at Junior World several years, and Carl Tucker was at BYU, and they'd spent some time down there, and Dwayne and spent some time there. And so I went down there and watched Warren. Well, there were no rules back then. So I got on that phone about three times a week, made a call to Durban, South Africans, kind of spoke off for cons a little bit. And BYU thought they had him. And so we had a double visit, and he was leaving Provo, and Carl's told him it doesn't snow here till December, and you'll be home for the holidays and whatever. Well, they almost didn't make their flight from Provo to Salt Lake. The snow was so bad, and he landed in Las Vegas, and it was 70 degrees. And he was from Durban, South Africa, and I knew at that point we were probably in pretty good shape. So yeah, I love Warren. His family became very, very good friends, and that was an incredible round. You'll remember that was when there was no cut at Poppy Hills, and we were on the other side of that. I think we started the day last day 18th, and Warren hit all five of the par fives and two. I think he shot 67 the last round, and it was just putting out as Phil teed off trying to win his fourth one, and couldn't quite do it. So that was pretty special to recruit a guy that ended up being an NCAA champion for sure.
Right. I mean, that's great. And so you go to work for Mike Holder at Oklahoma State, and you and I both have that together, you know, as sort of our small kinship. You throw a little Fred Warren in there, and you've got the three musketeers that worked for Mike. But So a couple of very interesting things happened during your time at Oklahoma State. And one of them was you and Mike built Carson Creek. And I've heard a lot of stories, and Mike's told me a bunch of stories. I've really never heard you talk much about it. So walk through that process a little bit, because that's a wonderful, unique experience for a young assistant coach to get.
Yeah, that was really one of the draws there to be part of that. And you know, I've become very good friends with Tom Fazio and that group, and that played a role in some of the things we've done in Atlanta. So obviously to work for Coach was an honor and a privilege. Taught me so much, and so did Dwayne. And they're very different people, different outlooks at things. But, you know, Mike, ultra successful. And so I thought, well, man, if you stick those two guys on my resume, at some point, something good might happen. So went and visited and talked about the golf course, got in the canoe and, you know, canoed up those channels and stuff and talked about everything. And finally, you know, Mike had enough money to do that. We walked that property with the briars and the snakes. And as you know, it was just straight, nothing but blackjack oaks. And just to watch how that whole process worked, to watch Tom go out and look at a topo map and figure out where to put the greens and how many green complexes there are. And then just to build, you know, then to tie in the tees for that. And there were a lot of holes there that are so pretty that we're really there just laying on the ground. And all you need to do is put a tee box and a green complex in. But that was a fascinating experience to learn that. Was part of the crew that, you know, kind of once you lay it out, then we have the survey crew and was part of that. And we actually cut a 4-foot wide swath down the middle of every fairway and was part of that with a machete. And there were days I wasn't real happy about that. But I did it anyway. And we staked a 100-foot thing every 100 feet we put a stake in. And then from there at every 100 feet, you have to go out and put a ribbon on the edges to where the bulldozer then can kind of track down right and left and push everything in the middle. And that's kind of where you get the movement in the fairway. For example, go down a hole and in the first stake, you say maybe 90 feet to the right, 130 feet to the left. You put a ribbon out there. Well, Mike, as you know, is fairly, trying to find the right word.
Detail oriented.
So he went out and bought a prism that looked 90 degrees in both directions. And the kids on the team helped us do that. And so I had a measuring tape tied to my right belt loop and one on the left. And I'd have the guys on the team with their ribbons and I'd go 80 and I'd walk up to the little stake and go, that's 80 feet to the right, 120 to the left. And Mike would not let them tie that ribbon on that lamb or whatever until they were inside the prism. And we did the whole golf course that way. And when Tom found out, he goes, Mike, those are just estimations. You're not going to treat it down. You're out of your mind. So remember doing that. So we got it all done. And we started clearing, and as you know, 14 is the widest fairway at Carson Creek, and there's a reason why. So it was a Saturday night, and the dozer, and we started there because it was the closest place to get into, and they had cleared the first 2/3 of that hole, pushed it all into the middle, and in Oklahoma, you don't need a lot of permits. You can kind of do what you want. So it was about 6 o'clock, and I looked at Mike, and he just wanted to start a fire. And I said, Coach, man, we don't have any water out here. I'm begging you, tomorrow's the Sabbath day. I don't want to work. Can we please wait till Monday when the water truck's supposed to be here to start that fire? Promise me you won't come out here tomorrow. Yeah, okay. So go to church, headed home on Highway 51, and all I can see is a pillar of smoke from the property. So I thought I'd just leave him out there to himself. But I couldn't do that. He'd been too good to me. So changed my clothes, ran out there, and the wind had kicked up. So the big piles of trees in the middle, the fire had jumped to the wild grass out in the rough and started burning stuff. And I looked at him, and he had on his pink polo shorts and a white polo shirt. And he pulled off those sunglasses, and all you could see were the whites of his eyes. I said, you're an idiot. He said, grab a rake and start stamping it down. And he sent his dad to Enid to try to get the fire truck. So that's a little bit of Carson Creek, but it was a tremendous learning experience for me, Mike, as far as irrigation. You know, we ended up building our own facility in Atlanta, and that stuff really, really came in handy. And, you know, it's funny. You know, sometimes he doesn't, well, you know, I think the world of a man, sometimes it's hard to get a compliment, I guess. It just, you know, it's expectations. And I think that's all good. And I've learned that. But I remember, you know, when the NCAA was headed back there again, you know, we missed. And I was so excited. We had a really good team. They were young. We missed by a stroke. And he called me and he said, he's sorry that we weren't coming. He said, I would like to have kicked your fanny in the finals. And I said, well, coach, I feel bad. You know, I've been telling my guys about this course and what we've done. And he said, that's where you need to really kind of tear it up a little bit. I said, I want you to know, everybody knows, and I know, you and I built this place. And I'll always appreciate the time that you and the effort you put into that. And to get that from him was pretty rewarding.
That's really cool. You know, yeah, Mike is not one to pass around compliments freely or, you know, in great amounts or great numbers. But I know that must have felt pretty good to hear that from
him. That was great.
Well, you know, but I do have another story. This is, to me, literally a perfect moment in Stillwater, Oklahoma. So he put you in charge of being a travel agent for the team, getting all the tickets, doing the vans, doing all that. Can you talk about like the most stressful time you ever had when you had that happen?
That's easy. As you know, you're a young coach, Mike, and what are you looking for? You're looking for responsibility, right?
For sure.
For sure. So he finally entrusted me with the tickets. And as you know, from having worked there, sometimes you fly out of Tulsa and sometimes you fly out of Oklahoma City. Where in Atlanta, it's pretty easy. If we're going to one place, we're going to Hartsville. So not a lot of decision making. So had the tickets, first time ever. And we're going to the preview in Columbus in the fall of 94. And I've got my tickets and I'm sitting up front and I'm in charge. And so we drive over, and for some reason I decided that we were flying out of Tulsa. So pull in there, and Mike's driven the van, and he always takes it to long-term parking, and then we go in and get the tickets. So TSA doesn't exist, and it's a little looser back then. And I walk up to the gate or the ticket counter, and I see this flight to Columbus, but it's like an hour different than what's on the ticket. And I was like, man, is the flight delayed? She said, no, let me see those tickets. She said, young man, these tickets are from Oklahoma City, which, as you know, is now about 2.5 hours away. So I didn't know what to say, and I just, something came to my mind, and I said, ma'am, have you ever in your life met the Grim Reaper? And she kind of looked at me, and she said, no, why? And I said, because, ma'am, he's in long-term parking, and he's going to be here in about 10 minutes, and if you don't fix this, we're both in a heap of trouble. So luckily for me, we went ahead and got him changed and were able to fly back in. But the story continues, because at that point he said, well, I can't give you anything to do. You're not responsible. I'm now taking back the tickets. So we're headed to Hawaii in January.
Have you sent a Christmas card to that lady at the ticket counter every year?
I should have got her name and sent her a check every year is what I should have done. So now it's January. We're headed to the Big Island. And I'm in the back in the van, and Robbie, his wife, is attending the tournament. So she's up front with Mike. And I can hear her every now and then, and it's, Mike, you sure we're going out of Oklahoma City? You got the tickets. And she's just riding him for about 35 miles. So we pass the oak tree exit, and all of a sudden she reaches down in Mike's bag that's in between the seats, and all of a sudden, guess where we're supposed to be flying out of?
Tulsa.
And all of a sudden, he whips that man around the middle of the median, about rolls it over and drives 120 miles an hour to make it. And I think I sat in the back of that van and I laughed for about 2 hours that it got him back.
Yeah, but see, both of you were resourceful and you got it done.
We got it done. Got it done. That's what I learned there. Get it done.
Which is great. So interesting. You and I could sit here and talk for hours just about our time in Stillwater and just the stories and all of that. So I wanted those couple stories to be told because I thought they were interesting and fun. And I do want you to talk about the 1995 NCAA, because at the time you had already, I believe, interviewed for the job at Georgia Tech. Is that correct?
No, they did not. You know, Coach Blackman kind of resigned or left the week of the NCAA, told his team on the way up there. So no, I had not spoken to them until it was a week or so, even after we returned from Columbus, was getting ready to work golf camp before they even called. So
you didn't know you were working your last tournament at Oklahoma State?
No, I did not know that.
Okay. But you did have a great team. Obviously had Alan Bratton and Chris Tidlin and Leif Westerberg and Chris Cox and Tripp Keeney. I mean, those guys were all first team All-Americans, had won everything in college except for the NCAA championship while you were there.
Yeah. Correct? You know, it really started, to be honest with you, in 94 at Stonebridge. We thought we had the best team. We're playing Tripp Keeney's home golf course. As you remember, Tripp drove the ball about as well as anyone I've ever seen. And that year he'd not had a penalty stroke with his driver, and we're second practice round in the morning, off comes the head down the driving range. And now we got to find a new driver for a guy that was pretty awesome. I think he hit three out of bounds during the tournament, and all of a sudden Stanford kind of had the, you know, the magical journey of shooting one of the lowest scores ever. And if you can go back to that scorecard, I believe there was an 80 posted by a Cardinal every day, including William Yanagisawa was 82 or 84 on the third round, leading into his 64 the last day. And so now these guys who'd redshirted waiting for Tiger win it a year before he shows up. So now you add him to this group coming back, and we've got everybody back. And so it's kind of mano a mano, you know, for an entire year. And that's a special group to be part of. I don't know how much you want to go to and the tournament and what happened and those kinds of things, but great guys. What I really appreciated there, really, well, Adam, I'd say Alan and Chris, were both there when I got there. And, you know, you join a new group and you're never really sure if you're going to be accepted or not. And those two guys really made me feel wanted and there. And we remained great friends to this day. Obviously a little more touch with Alan because he's coaching. But those two guys really, they redshirted that my first year there and really, really made me feel welcome. And I'll always appreciate that.
Yeah, that was a special group of guys. I think they were all academic All-Americans, all Americans on the golf course. And you guys walked out of the Scarlet course that day with the national championship trophy. Really, what was the first sudden death playoff in the history of the NCAA championship. But part of that playoff is what's really interesting because you weren't there to see it.
No, I was there. That's the misnomer.
Okay.
Yeah. We found a ride for Leif to the airport. And so I had walked with him that day. My job that week was to walk with the Swede. If you'll remember, there was only one coach permitted to coach and give advice.
Right.
So I was told just walk on the car path and encourage the guy from there. So first round doesn't count. Second round doesn't count. Third round doesn't count. So Mike goes, are you going to get anything out of this guy this week? And he turns in 38 and I go, well, 0-for-4. And the dude manned up and made three birdies on the back and shot 71 and counted. And his last putt just kind of went in right before another one of the delays. So I said to Mike, you know, what do we do? He's got this $1,800 ticket to the British Am. He said, look, Bruce, I'll tell you right now, we're not in first place. We have not been in first place all week. If you're telling me when this is all over, we're tied and we're in some playoff, we'll go play with four guys, get him a ride to the airport.
Okay.
So got him in a car and watched it finish. And, kind of went back and watched Alan birdie his last three holes of regulation and kind of dodged a bullet with Noda and Tiger at the last hole with 10, 12 footers, maybe the only 10 footer ever saw Tiger miss. And so next thing you know, we're in a playoff.
That was amazing. And then Alan, obviously.
Birdied the first playoff hole again. So last four holes.
Yeah, made Chris about also a 35 birdie. Footer. You talk about a secure legacy as far as how you finished your career out. That's pretty amazing. But so you win the national championship. You're on top of the world, and you get a call from Georgia Tech a week later, correct?
Yes.
So before I move on there, was when you got the call, were you pretty much in your mind thinking this is going to happen?
No, I mean, you know, I've learned one thing that, you know, I felt good that they called me. I've kind of learned that you don't really apply for stuff. Most people like to try to go out and feel good about finding somebody. But, you know, I was just an assistant, and at that time you know, they just finished with David Duval and Stuart Sink, and Stuart had just won the Haskins Award. It was been one of the, you know, the nation's best programs for the previous 10 or 12 years. So no assumptions made whatsoever. Just, again, didn't apply. Homer Rice called and said, we'd like to talk to you, and kind of went down and got a ride from the airport and sat down in his office. And he said, well, young man, let me tell you something. You're no longer being interviewed. I've coached three different groups of people, those who've just finished playing, those who are playing, and some coaches. And it's your job if you want it. So now you're going to spend the next two or three days interviewing us, which that's kind of when I lost it. Not, you know, I had no idea that was going to happen. And all of a sudden I'm sitting there. I was more worried about which fork to use in the South at dinner and not mess it up from an etiquette standpoint. So then, you know, then it became, you know, real life. And, you know, we were in the middle of adopting our son and knew that my wife would like to stay home and be a stay-at-home mother if she could. And obviously the salary was going to be large enough to be able to do that. So at that point, once kind of all worked out, it seemed to kind of make sense for us.
Well, that's great. And you obviously you took over a program that had been really good for several years, but there wasn't much left in the cupboard when you first got there. I know your first year was pretty brave to bear.
Yeah, I think five last place finishes, including the ACC championship, losing to a program that only had 2.5 scholarships was a little tough to take. And, you know, you win 9 the year before and the national championship, and all of a sudden you finish last 5 times, including the conference, and you just start to wonder if, you know, if you just, were you ready and did you know what you were doing and how fast things can change. So that was certainly a tough year, but we went out and I'd been obviously recruiting at a very high level with different players, working for Mike, and was fortunate enough to be in on some guys that were recruiting to Stillwater, and flipped over and had a really good class, first class with Matt Kuchar and Wes Latimer and Nick Cassini, who ended up transferring to Georgia and helped them win a national championship. So, and then followed that up with Bryce Mulder. And within 2 years, you know, things flipped pretty quickly for us.
Yeah. In fact, before we go to the rest of your story, I'm going to give a little capsule of your career. And I told you earlier today that it was the first time I had looked at your sort of accolades, your accomplishments, your career accomplishments to this point. You're not even close to being through. But I hadn't looked at it in a while, and it was certainly impressive to me. So here, I'm gonna give this, if you'll just give me a second. You got it?
I got it. I'm afraid it just means I'm old. I don't know.
It's pretty good, because a lot of people can stick around this long, but they won't have these same records. So,
all right.
Coach of the Year 10 times. You've won the ACC Championship 13 times. You've won 4 regional championships. 3 times you've coached the NCAA runner-up national championship team. 1998, 2002, 2005. 4 times you've made match play in the 11 years we've had match play at the national championship. You've coached 1 NCAA individual champion at Georgia Tech. That's Troy Madison in 2002. You're the Palmer Cup coach twice. You've had 22 regional appearances and 17 NCAA final appearances. And you were inducted into the GCAA Hall of Fame in 2013. 12 of your former players are currently on the PGA Tour or the Corn Ferry Tour. Bruce, that's pretty incredible. I mean, that's a great, great career. I don't care who you are. I don't care what Georgia Tech thought they were getting. I don't know if they ever thought it could ever be something like this. So congratulations on that.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, I've got a great amount of respect for you and the way you take care of your business. If somebody told me, you know, who would you trust with your life, and you had one guy, I think I could throw you in that mix of somebody that I think you do it the right way. I love the way you do it. And you've been hyper successful for a very long time, and you've got a great team again. So anyway, I wanted those people at Georgia Tech who are still around that remember you being hired. I can't even imagine they thought this was possible over the time you've been here, but That's really an amazing, amazing record. So
thank you.
You bet. Well, and I didn't mean to embarrass you. I just kind of wanted to make sure that the people listening understood the totality of all of the things you've been able to accomplish. And I know it's been the players' accomplishments. Those kids.
Yes, have done it. Certainly. Yeah, they've done the work.
You recruited them and you coached them and you motivated them. So that's what I want to do before we move on to some other subjects I've got. My assistant coach, Mikkel, had a request. He wanted me to ask you, tell us your coaching style. I know you coached for Dwayne Knight, and you said Dwayne and Mike Holder were very, very different. I'm sure you've morphed together some of the things you learned from both. But what is your coaching style? How do you go about helping guys get better? How do you motivate players? What is your style, Bruce?
Well, I should try to put that all together. Mike, I think the first thing I've learned is this is really a self-esteem battle. We all do a lot of losing. What appears to be losing, when every other team plays against in a competition, maybe other than cross country or something, you know, half the people leave, they're happy. And you go to some really good college golf tournaments and you finish 6th or 7th, and you can go a whole year and not win a tournament and have a team that's ranked in the top 10 if you kind of play that a certain type of schedule. So I think it's very easy to not feel like you're winning and you're not being successful. So I've just kind of learned early on that how do we develop their self-esteem? And, you know, there's 2 ways, you know, there's 1 way to get a lot done, and that's to mandate a lot of work and mandate practices and really try to just make them do stuff. And obviously if you spend time at anything, you improve. But I just kind of sat around and I just decided that wasn't it, because I really want a young man going to bed at night believing that he chose to do all of that stuff rather than I made him do all of that stuff. So it was, how do you create a culture with a lot of structure that they can't see or recognize? And so that's kind of been my thought process, is I think we have a wonderful culture. We talk a lot about, you know, decisions. Life is another concept, is, you know, life and our success is the sum of every decision that we ever make. And you add those up and the numbers don't lie. And so we kind of created something early on called the Pride Meter. And I've tried to convince the young men at our place that as you go throughout your day, if you're turn that up to a 3 when you go to class, or it's 4 when you work out, or it's 5.5 when you go on a date or do your homework, but all of a sudden you're really committed to your golf, and you turn that up to a 10 for the 4, 5, 6, 7 hours that you're doing your golf, you know what you are? You're about a 6.5. And I really think that life is about being the total person. And I found that, I think if you're going to play golf for a long time, and really happy for our guys who have done that, I think you have to have the proper perspective. And I really believe if you don't get out of golf as who you are and turn it into what you do, you have no chance of playing golf long term, because it'll be 77 good, bad Mike McGraw, 67 good Mike McGraw, and you cannot live on that roller coaster. And so, you know, our academics is a challenge. I think it can be a challenging wherever you go, depending on what you want to major in and how successful that you want to be. But I may be crazy, but I believe that if you can succeed in other areas of your life, whether that's how you treat people, the student that you are, if you can find some other things so that when you shoot 74, it's okay, because you're still a smart guy and you're still a hardworking guy. And it evens those things out. So the Pride Meter has kind of been something that I've preached. Let's just set it up at 10 on the scale every morning when we wake up. And everything we do is at that level. And Mike, I really believe that when guys have left our place, you know, what you do at 6, 7, 9, 10, whatever out today, it's no longer, you're not making decisions anymore. It's just kind of who you've become. I don't think you make a decision at what time. I know you're a very disciplined person. I don't think Mike McGraw decides at 6 o'clock in the morning whether you're going to get up or not. You just get up and do Mike McGraw. And so that's kind of what we've tried to create on a day in and day out basis. Some of the things you didn't mention is the academic success that our guys have had. You know, 4 Byron Nelson Award winners. I think there are only 2 Division I golf programs left with perfect APR scores since the inception of the award. That's 16 years now. We've had a perfect score every time. If you add up the academic. So I feel really good about that, because I think that shows they're making choices. And all of a sudden you walk in our place and the goal isn't just to stick an All-American plaque up on the top. It's to put one on the top and down below and just try to create a place where guys make really, really good choices. And I think I might have something. No, it was my other notebook. I was a Chinese philosopher that he really believes a successful leader is someone that when they leave your care, they really don't even think you helped them. That you've almost been invisible, and that I've tried to tell them to take credit for their winning shots. You know, you want to be grateful and say thank you. That's fine, but it's just been a methodology of trying to convince them that everything that they do and every success they have is not because of me or Georgia Tech or where we play or whatever. It's because they did the work, they hit the shots, and they made the putts, and I had nothing to do with it. So that's just kind of a general idea at tournaments. I'm a big believer in having a really great practice round. And then at that point, I'm not going to be there at Q school, may not get to all the par threes, may do all that stuff. And at that point, it's time for them to go do their stuff. I mean, they're hitting shots off balls above their feet, below their feet. They're not looking for me to help them. And we walk up on a par 3 and there's a perfectly flat tee box and put on a tee, and I can look around and look for Coach Helper to tell him what to do. And so I've been very much into trying to being self-determining program, and you go ahead and make your decisions. And when you're successful, you can feel good about that. Maybe a long answer, but that's kind of probably most of it.
Yeah, I love that philosophy, Bruce. And I think that that plays into a tenet that I've coached with for a long, long time. And that is how you do anything is how you do everything. So if you're a good friend, a good student, a good guy in the workout room, great. You know, if you do all these things well, I mean, it's going to show up in the totality of what you're doing. That's why I know you're very proud of the academics. And at Baylor, we have done the same thing, but for 9 years in a row that you said. You've done 16 years in a row at Georgia Tech. Yeah. That's amazing. So I think that the whole player, I think that that's undervalued, that the whole person and what they're becoming. And I think you can be successful in both. And you've proven that you can be successful in both. And so, I mean, and I'd like to move from that point to just, you've got the reigning NCAA or the U.S. amateur champions are Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets. So Andy Ogletree won it in 2019 and Tyler Stravassi won it in 2020. And if you go back to your second or third year at Georgia Tech, Matt Kuchar won. You're the only coach coaching college golf right now who has three U.S. amateur players that have played in your team. And those kids also made good grades. So, I mean, how can you say that school gets in the way? It doesn't. It's, to me, it complements everything you're trying to do in anything you're doing.
Yeah, I just think if your entire self-worth is dependent upon a scorecard, it's going to be a long day and, you know, a long life. You know, Mike, I talk to guys all the time, and, you know, golf has become very, very, very instruction-oriented. But I've tried to share with my guys, I really believe that just had a young man go finish fifth and sixth at South Beach and then the Orlando Amateur. And I just finally talked to him when he got back. I said, so did your golf swing finish fifth and sixth or did you? Because there's just been this whole switch to just swing. And obviously you have to reach a certain level of competency. That's a given, but it's more about dealing with expectations and, you know, to watch young guys, you know, now you win something. Now you're supposed to be somebody different. And it's like Andy, you know, wins that with another year of school left. Well, now every tournament he goes to, he feels like he's got to defend the fact that he's the amateur champion. And I think that's where you can be really, really valuable and maybe crawl out of the van driver title that some people give us is, you know, you and I've been around this a long time and watched and learned ourselves from people and things and experiences. And I think you can be really helpful. I think one of the biggest challenges is a player improves is his own expectations and then they lose their patience. And so there's so much involved in being a golf coach that if you spend time with your kids, I think you can really be a value to them in many, many different veins.
I agree. And I've watched you in action all through these years. And I've watched sort of in awe just because I know that you've got one of the most successful programs in the country and you can see the way that your kids carry themselves. I really like that. It's fun to watch. So I appreciate you giving us just a little insight to sort of your coaching style and your philosophy of your program at Georgia Tech. I'm going to say something I think that most people don't think about or know about in your Hall of Fame career. And that is your ability to fundraise. So if you could, there's a lot of coach, that's become a very, very important part of our jobs, fundraising, be able to keep up in the facilities arms race, if you will. How have you been able to be such a successful fundraiser at Georgia Tech and build facilities and do what you've done in that area?
Well, I was fortunate again to work with Dwayne and Mike, probably two of the most prolific fundraisers in the history of our sport. And to see what Mike did to raise, you know, Dwayne comes to Las Vegas and there isn't anything. And the next thing you know, there's a foundation and the scholarships are endowed and one thing leads to another. And you could just see what the resources, how they can change things and change opportunities and what you can do. And then to go work for Mike, who maybe has done it as well as anybody and raised the money to build the golf course and do things there. So first of all, I learned that it was important and it was necessary and it wasn't something to be bemoaned. It was something to realize that this is how you make a difference. And so I was fortunate when I got to Georgia Tech. Puggy had done some of that. There was a group there and I guess I kind of got lucky, Mike. He made some comments as he went out the door of kind of the shortfalls. Didn't have a place to, our own golf course. He was going to South Carolina because they built one. And he really didn't share any of those with the guys as he walked out the door, but he shared them in an article in Golf Week. And my folks are fairly competitive in life and in things. And so I basically had this blueprint of look what we're missing. And they basically was, well, why didn't he tell us? And so, you know, kind of had some thoughts as to what we need to do. Obviously, Mike felt it was important. You know, they used to play at Lakeside, then they went to Stillwater Country Club, and he knew that just wasn't enough. And he had to have his own place. And so I got to Atlanta and believed I had to have my own place. So one is to see the needs and actually see what you can do when you get some things done. So there was a group that was there that were called had a golf group, and one thing led to another, and sat down with this committee and said, hey, we got to find a place to go. We got to do some things and change stuff. And they said, well, man, I wish he told us. You know, we were selling the fact that there's 50 golf courses in Atlanta. I said, well, that's great if you can get on any of them. But day to day, that's a little tough. So went around and looked at some things and realized it's expensive, but we're able to join the Golf Club of Georgia. That, you know, that was $250,000 and that raised that money. And I think the key to it, and when we joined East Lake, and then I found some property near campus and renovated that and finally got a hold of it. And you know, now 25 years later, you know, it's close to $24-25 million that we've raised. And, you know, I look at it from, I don't spend a minute of my day in any location where I spent it 25 years ago. New offices. We have a suite in the football stadium for our donors. But what I found the way to do that is people love these young people. If you have the right kids in your program, it's really pretty simple. And so we have an event. Used to be when I got there, a group would get the guys to get together. But I watched Mike do this, and he would put at the Cowboy Pro-Am, he would put a former or current student with each group. So now you have these wonderful people who are invested in your program and they're enjoying the success. And all of a sudden they're sitting in that cart and they look over at that young person or older person, if it's Matt Kuchar or whatever, and go, you know what? I was part of that. And look what we're doing here. Look what we're producing. We put the product, we put the Apple Watch right there in front of them. And so they spend 4 or 5 hours with those kids and they sit down and have dinner with them. And, you know, I can support this. You know, I can get behind this. And so we've just put great young men in front of wonderful, successful people who love their school. And obviously the success doesn't hurt. But first, it's the vision to think, who would have ever thought 25 years ago we would be members where they play the tour championship, full status, and belong to one of the finest clubs in Atlanta, the Golf Club of Georgia. And now have a, you know, a $16 million practice facility that's five blocks from campus in the middle of downtown, that now that property might be worth $30 million. I mean, you know, we're for some guys with some vision, but I think the key is having these wonderful young men succeeding in the classroom and on the golf course, be around these guys that love their school. And, you know, I feel very strong that, you know, Mike had incredible loyalty to the Cowboy Pro-Am. I mean, Bob and those guys, it was like they dropped everything, you know, to come and do that. And I've tried to, you know, let guys know that it's bigger than them and it's bigger than me. This thing is whatever you want to describe it as, you know, it's bigger than Bryce Mulder. It's bigger than Matt Kuchar. And to share that with the younger guys and know that, you know, the reason why we got to go to Hawaii 20 years ago was because the fundraiser. And so I think this fall we had 45 groups on two courses, and we're able to stick a former player or a current player with each group. And it just has really made the event pretty special. And I just had, you know, we had good people too. I mean, it's some wonderful people have got involved in the program. We've endowed our scholarships and done some other things. And that effort is still ongoing from that standpoint. But I think to not look at it begrudging like this, another thing I have to do, I've tried to share with those other coaches at Georgia Tech, there's no leprechaun dropping those gold coins off in front of my office every morning. You kind of got to go out and do those things. So great people, great kids, and just trying to put them together.
Well, and you and I both worked for Mike, who obviously was very good at that. We both have done it in our own special different way possibly. But I wanted other people listening to this to understand that's part of a college golf coach's job. And that doesn't make you a CEO, but it does make you something along those lines. You have to go out and raise the capital and do the work and build the relationships and do the things to build the infrastructure for a strong, strong program. And I don't think a lot of young coaches understand that's a very important thing, especially going forward financially. It's not like money's just, like you said, falling out of trees. You've got to go get it.
So. No, I think there's some real concern from some of the guys that I'm friends with about, you know, what's the future of this? Programs are being cut, and it's an article about how most ADs really just care about football and basketball. You know, what are we going to do? And this year is a perfect example, Mike. I walked in and they wanted a 20% budget cut. And we've got a little reserve fund that's about $800,000 to $1 million that we just save for a rainy day. And I was able to walk into my boss and go, look, I got you, man. This is what we've made this money for. We took three nice team trips in the fall. And I said, you know what? If you'll pay our salaries, we take care of everything else. So this year, we're going to spend about $250,000 from our reserve fund. I promise you that the money we're spending here in Arizona was from the fundraiser. This is not just extra money that Georgia Tech's got lying around. We've got the same problems that everybody else has, but my boss appreciated that fact. And so my goal was, and I learned from Mike, both Mike and Dwayne, is you don't want to ever sell something that you can't keep in place. You don't sell kids something and then a year into it go backwards. And so we've been able to do that this year so far. We didn't get to play in the fall, but we had three nice team trips. And now we're here at Arizona and we've got a wonderful spring plan. We're trying to be as careful as we can with the, you know, with the virus and do some things, but really this whole spring that we're going to be engaging in is all done with fundraising dollars.
And that is amazing. I think that's wonderful. One, that you were able to go out and raise the money and continue to do that, but two, that you would walk into the office of the athletic director and say, we got this, we can handle this time. And so that's really amazing. So let's talk about your spring schedule. You know, we know the ACC and the Big Ten and the Pac-12 didn't get to play golf in the fall. So Big 12 and the SEC did. So we know you guys were looking at us wishing you could be playing. But it looks like you're going to play this spring. Where do you guys start? And talk to me about your spring season.
Yeah, an effort to kind of make up for what happened. You know, we were looking at having a couple U.S. amateur champions back and Luke back. And I wanted to create a really nice year for them. And so we kind of committed to this, a lot of this before. The second disappointment was just a little too much for everybody. Obviously, we had a really good team last year, didn't get a play. And then we canceled the fall again, and they've chosen to go on and have created some great opportunities for themselves. But we've added a couple of events to kind of make up for the fall. Trey Jones has been kind enough to host us down in Panama City. The ACC tournament now is becoming going on a rotational basis rather than always up at Old North State. So a year from now, we'll be going to Florida, down to Panama City. So Trey's offered to host us there Martin Luther King weekend. So that's something new for us, which is Willoughby. We're starting early with qualifying and stuff. So we'll play down there, come home. Michael Beard was kind enough to hold us a spot. So we'll have a chance to play on the Golf Channel, hopefully, out at North Ranch after that. So those are two. Before we usually go to Hawaii, we're going to stay in LA and then head on over, hopefully, to Kona. My son actually is on his honeymoon in Honolulu. So I know you can get to Hawaii right now. We'll see if we can still get there. Again, obviously, the world is very uncertain and we don't know things, but want again to provide the experience that I promised these young people when we recruit them about where we play and what we do. So go to Kona, come home a couple weeks, and then fly back to Palm Springs and play in Wyoming's tournament at the Classic Club. I've heard it's a great golf course. So go home for a couple weeks and play there and then come home. Going to go down to an event that's kind of been around a long time, the Linger Longer, play down in Lake Oconee, which is a little van ride for us, and play down there. And then turned around and we got lucky. Spring break fell on Stanford's tournament in Palo Alto. So we're going to go to Monterey for 4 or 5 days ahead of time and then head on up to Palo Alto and play there, come home for a week or two. And we didn't get to play last year. There's a neat event down at Calusa Pines in Naples, and go down and play kind of a little small tournament there, get warmed up. And then obviously we're looking forward to having the ACCs in Atlanta at Crab Apple and then hopefully some postseason.
Boy, that's a great schedule. And I mean, you get to fly a bunch too. It's not like you have to drive everywhere you go.
No. And you know, we're being careful. Obviously the contact tracing is a big challenge, as you know. So there were, you know, 10 of us on in everywhere time we go in a car, we've got mask and a shield on, same on the plane. And we go out and get all their meals every night. We don't go out to dinner. Trying to follow all of those recommendations. Guys all have their own hotel rooms, so no one's with anybody. So that watch how the carts are done and kind of learn something from our football coaches, follow us to create these small groups so that you don't lose five guys with maybe somebody testing positive. So we're trying to do the best we can to keep the kids safe and do the things to kind of keep them very, very distanced. And I still feel like I'd rather be in control of where they're spending their time and making some decisions for them as to where they are. And we've got them. And I, we have a great group, Mike. Obviously they were heartbroken last March, maybe had arguably maybe one of the best teams we've ever had and didn't get to finish that. And so they'd already lost a postseason, and they understand that the way they take care of themselves and where they spend their time and how they go about this being careful. I've told them beginning of the year that this season is on y'all. If we've got the money, we've got permission, got some great things to do, but if you're not willing to sacrifice your social life and those kind of things, then it all might get blown up. So they've been great so far, and I think they understand what's at stake, their health as well as our season.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think when you obviously you probably have team leaders that are leading the surge on that to try to get guys to do the right things, and that's great that they'll do that. So you didn't get to play in the fall, but you did do something in the fall. So can you describe anything creative that you did? So some coaches might not get to play this spring. Some of the smaller schools, maybe mid-majors, I don't know who would not get to play, but what are some of the things you guys did in the fall that were creative to keep their interest?
Well, we were fortunate again with resources. And so we went ahead and took three team trips that, you know, guys who don't usually get to go, as you know, that can be a very heartbreaking experience for number seven or number eight some years, right? You don't hardly even get to play.
Right.
So we got permission and we're really careful. And we went down and spent some time at Sea Island and played some rounds there as a team so that everybody got to go to try to keep, you know, the team together, keep them engaged in what we're doing. And then we took another trip down to Lake Oconee and played a couple days down there. Or, you know, obviously, as long as you don't miss class, you can kind of go more than you used to. And then we went up to the played at the farm a couple of days and the honors course in Chattanooga. So we really kind of had three team trips where we competed and kept score, and they created some team games and some competition within themselves. So I really felt like it kept us engaged as a group. I had a great semester in the weight room, I think, because we kept them together. I think if we just kind of let them go or stay home or be on their own, I don't think we would be where we are with my team right now. I think they've gotten very close. They know those guys aren't here anymore and it's their turn and it's on their shoulders. And I think these trips in the fall, again, having the money to do that, obviously I understand not everybody doesn't, but I think that was really critical to whatever this group turns out to be this spring.
Well, but, you know, even if you didn't have the resources, you still have the ability to get guys together and keep them engaged, keep them working regardless. So regardless of if you get to take a big trip or if you have to do it at home, just keeping guys interested, keeping guys motivated.
Yeah. Even though the classes were online, most of them and stuff, and they didn't really, I mean, I know some people just let their kids go home. Our guys live in some apartments across the street from the practice facility, and we were fortunate that we were able to keep it open. They didn't want to go home. They really like each other and they realize they're going to get better around each other. And so really from that standpoint, the day-to-day from the lifting to everything else was like nothing really changed. And that was really positive for our group, I think.
That's great. Well, so we're going to have two more things I want to do here on this podcast. One is I want to do a speed round, but I'm going to do that last. Okay. And you've got, those are something I haven't prepared you for that. But you're a pretty quick thinker. You think quickly on your feet, think you'd be fine. But the other thing I was going to ask you was just give me the main thing about college golf to you that's changed for the better since you got in 26 years ago at Georgia Tech.
Oh, well, you added that last part for the better. Well, I think it's pushed all of us. I talked the story about being at Lake Merced. I'm trying to think what year that would be.
1989.
And really, Mike and I were the only two people who stayed for match play. That's how little recruiting was done. Everybody kind of watched the first two rounds and they went home. And I mean, I'm staying to the end because he's staying to the end. And now to watch what college golf has become, so many people working, so many great places, so many great coaches. You know, I think at the time we talked about maybe me being the only full-time guy. And now there's all these young men who have become assistant coaches and have moved on. And now they're coaching. Like when I landed in Atlanta, I didn't need anyone to tell me what to do. I knew where to go. I knew where the players were. I had a really idea how to run a program. And that's different than maybe hiring someone off the street, a PGA professional or some whatever. And so now, and I say this for the better, because now recruiting's a lot harder. There's a lot more people trying, but what it's done is created so many more great places for all of these young kids to go. I mean, you know the experience those kids at Louisville are going to have with Ryan Blagg there. And I know what's going on at Colorado State with Christian Newton and so on and so forth. And I think the greatest thing that's happened is you went from about 30 great places in 1988 when I started to now maybe over 100 of these, you know, wonderful men who care about their kids and raise money and coach them and recruit them. And so I just feel that by far and away, there's so many more great places for these young people to go than there was when I first started. And that's certainly a positive.
That is a positive. I think college golf has advanced itself in amazing. Plus, we've got our national championship on television now, which is bringing great exposure to everything for college golf involved. So I agree with you. I think we're better off now than we've ever been, and we have more great teams and more great places to go. Really good. So well said, Bruce. Okay, before we end, I need to get you back to your team. Anyway, you probably have to have dinner in a few minutes. I would like to do a speed round with you. So you can take as long as you want on these questions, but we do like to see that it's called a speed round, Bruce.
All right,
here we go. You ready? Favorite golf course where you've coached in college? Wow.
Cypress Point.
Okay, Cypress Point. Very good. Favorite golf course.
Sorry. Steak. I had some good choices. I'm sorry.
Steak or seafood?
Steak.
Eskimo Joe's cheese fries or Outback Awesome Blossom?
Oh, Eskimo Joe's cheese fries. It's not even close.
Okay. And those will kill you if you eat too many of those.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Best putter you've ever coached?
Bryce Mulder.
Best driver you've ever coached?
Troy Madison.
Very good. Shawshank Redemption or Remember the Titans?
Remember the Titans for the 15th time.
Oh, I'm with you. That is a great show. All right. So would you rather go an hour on the Stairmaster on level 18 or eat a side of broccoli?
I'll do the workout.
I knew you would. You still don't eat green, do you, Bruce? Still
no, zero. No greens.
Any superstitions?
No, not really.
Okay, no superstitions. Favorite pro sports teams, are they in Georgia or Utah?
It's the Utah Jazz.
So go ahead.
I'm a Jazz man. I've tried to root for the Falcons. I do try to go for the local teams. I love the Braves, always have. Used to watch Dale Murphy when I was a kid and when it first started on cable. But yeah, I'm a Jazz man.
Okay. All right. I just didn't know if the allegiance was still out west, and it looks like it is. All right. Final question. Your dream foursome, you and three other people, who would you play golf with if you had a choice?
I'm going to go with Nicklaus and Tiger Woods and Bobby Jones.
Wow. You just went with three of the greatest players who have ever touched a golf club. Well done, Bruce.
Well, if we're going to do a dream round, we might as well get it done.
I love it. Well, Bruce, thank you so much for taking the time out of your trip to Arizona to talk to me. You've given us some great insight to what's made you successful, what's made your program successful, and just what's great about college golf. So I really appreciate you taking the time. And I really, really hope and believe we're going to get to see each other some point later this spring.
I can't wait. Thanks, Mike, and thanks for your friendship.
Absolutely. Same to you, Bruce. Appreciate it. Have a good week.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you.